Rise up, sunshine. Welcome to the show. I'm Coy Wire. This is CNN 10, and we got your news for this January 15th, the birth date of one of the most important leaders in American history, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Born in 1929, right here in Atlanta, Georgia, he became a Baptist minister and a powerful voice for civil rights. Dr. King led peaceful protests to challenge racism and segregation, believing that change should come through nonviolence. His famous "I Have a Dream" speech inspired millions to imagine a more equal nation. In 1964, he won the Nobel Peace Prize, and his legacy continues to shape the fight for justice today. Happy birthday, sir. Next up, also on this day in history, January 15th, 2009, a story that still feels impossible years later. A passenger plane lost both engines just after takeoff over one of the busiest cities in the world, and the pilot's split-second decision saved dozens of lives. Just minutes after takeoff from New York's LaGuardia Airport, U.S. Airways Flight 1549 runs into trouble.
Cactus 1539, it burns, so you've lost thrust on both engines, returning back towards LaGuardia.
Okay, you need to return to LaGuardia. Turn left, heading up 220.
220.
Tower, stop your departure, it's got emergency returning.
A bird strike. Birds entering both engines causes an immediate loss of power. With no runway within reach, Chesley Sully Sullenberger makes a split-second decision to land on the Hudson River.
We're unable. We may end up in the Hudson.
All 155 passengers and crew on board survived. Investigators later confirmed that Sullenberger made the safest possible call, and the landing became known as the Miracle on the Hudson.
In aviation, the bottom line is that the single most important piece of safety equipment is an experienced, well-trained pilot.
Next up, a space flight that's made history, shattering the ceiling on who gets to soar among the stars. A paraplegic engineer from Germany is now officially part of space history. Michaela Michi-Benthaus is a mechatronics and aerospace engineer at the European Space Agency, disability advocate, and now the first wheelchair user to fly above the Kármán line, the internationally recognized edge of space. 7 years after a mountain biking accident and a spinal cord injury, Benthaus says her life changed, but her lifelong dream of going to space did not.
I think there was not like this one moment where I realized that my dream of going to space is not over.
Blue Origin says the spacecraft itself didn't need redesigning because accessibility was part of the original New Shepard design, while ground systems like elevator access and improved harnesses help astronauts get in and out safely. Benthaus says being first isn't just about space, it's about inclusion for everyone.
I feel like a little bit the responsibility of being the first wheelchair user is also to point back on Earth. Of course, if we want to be an inclusive society, we should be inclusive in every part and not only in the parts we like to be.
Minutes later, main engine cutoff, separation, and permission to float.
You're in space.
Hey, guys.
After a brief trip above the Earth, the capsule returns safely to the desert in Texas.
You told me after the accident that you thought this dream of going to space was no longer possible. You just showed the world that it is possible. What would you say to folks that have given up on a dream because they thought it was impossible?
I think you should never give up on your dreams, right? But I mean, there's also sometimes just a low probability that it comes true. And I just got very lucky, and I'm very grateful that Blue and Hans and everyone said yes to this journey.
Pop quiz, hotshot. In the early 1900s, which innovation helped popularize typewriters in offices? Battery power, carbon paper, touch typing, or colored ink? If you said touch typing, you are within the margins. It is a technique where you don't look at the keyboard, relying on muscle memory. All 10 fingers start from the home row. ASDF for the left hand, JKL for the right. Have you heard of a trend where some people are choosing to revert back to a more analog version of a cell phone in an attempt to spend less time scrolling on social media and other apps on a smartphone? Well, a similar revolution is unfolding when it comes to laptops, where some students and employees are choosing to complete writing assignments and tasks on a typewriter instead of an internet-connected computer. Our Rafael Romo speaks with a typewriter collector about what's old becoming new again.
Typewriters are making a comeback. What is it that a computer cannot do that a typewriter can?
The typewriter removes distractions from the writing process.
Writers like J.K. Rowling of Harry Potter fame, as well as pop stars like Lady Gaga and Taylor Swift, have publicly expressed they are fans.
I think all of these people have found that the typewriter enables that creative process.
So says Tom Repkoff, better known as Typewriter Tom, who for decades has fixed and collected typewriters.
This is called a catacombs because it has that sort of eerie feeling to it.
How many machines do you think you have all together in these rooms?
All together in these rooms, probably 1,000 machines spread across pretty much every manufacturer since late 1800s.
While many manual typewriter shops have closed their doors, new stores have recently opened in Merrimack, New Hampshire, Dayton, Ohio, and Chicago.
See, this is called a type shuttle.
The renewed interest in typewriters keeps Rekoff busy, leading meetings of the Atlanta Typewriter Club he founded.
I would say this is early 1900s.
And visiting schools and museums where he introduces younger generations to typewriters.
Every time I go to a school, I leave them a typewriter. I get haikus back from the kids. I get pictures back that they typed, and I love it. That's just the fun of doing it.
A childhood accident left a young man with lasting scars. Years later, it led him to a calling few would dare to choose. This is the journey of Terry McCarty.
This burn survivor faced his fears to become a firefighter himself.
That first fire, when it actually became active, really kind of gave me a lot of throwbacks to when my accident happened.
When Terry McCarty was just 6 years old, an accident caused burns over 73% of his body after his brothers lit a bowl of kerosene on fire.
So the full bowl of flaming kerosene flew at me. It hit me in the chest and effectively caught me on fire. The neighbor came home, saw what was happening. He grabbed his sleeping bag that he had in his car, came over and tackled me and put me out.
What followed was a long physical and emotional road to recovery.
I would have 58 surgeries over a period of 10 years. It was really difficult because I'd missed a lot of school due to the surgeries, and then also didn't have very good friend support because, you know, I wasn't constantly at school going to things like that.
Even as an adult, McCarty found employers unwilling to give him a fair chance.
I tried to get a job as an oil technician, and the manager that was on duty that day told me that I would be a liability, that I wouldn't be able to go work for him. So that's why I went out and decided, what's the one thing I can do that would just stop everybody in their tracks?
This photo of McCarty captures the moment his training as a volunteer firefighter became deeply personal.
When the fire reached me in the training and it kind of went over me, it took any kind of remaining fear issues or anything like that that I really had with it.
Today, McCarty volunteers at the same camp for child burn victims that he attended, and he has transitioned to work in peer mental health counseling.
When people happen to have that same kind of internal trauma and they see me, you know, that really breaks down a lot of barriers for people to understand that, you know, I've been through some things myself. My job is to really just connect with people and help them realize that, you know, in their journey of healing, really, they are in the captain's seat for this process. I'm just a navigator.
Today's story getting a 10 out of 10, the good old-fashioned compassion of a student which turned a school pantry into a place of support for an entire community. During her senior year at Ames High School in Iowa, Caitlin Okerlin learned about food systems in class while seeing more families rely on food pantries due to the government shutdown. So she created simple grab-and-go meal kits from her school's pantry to make dinner time easier for families.
The pantry got a big increase in people who kind of needed it. So just making it as simple as possible, like grab and go. We looked for things that are completely shelf stable, high in protein, that'll be filling.
The kits include multiple meals, recipes, even birthday cake kits, because celebrating still matters even during hard times. What started as one student's mission has quickly grown. The pantry is in partnership with the Food Bank of Iowa and has become a central hub for similar pantries, helping to meet the demand across the community. Caitlin spends about 4 hours each week at the pantry, determined to make the most of her time before she graduates.
I mean, this is super fun. It's super rewarding. We're looking for more recipes and to expand and like hear what people like, what they want more of.
Turning class lessons into community action. Now that is a 10 out of 10. Okay, what do you say? We have two shout-outs for you today. The first one goes to Miss Bradshaw at Riverdale High School in Jefferson, Louisiana. Thank you for including us in your classroom. Rise up. And Valley View Middle School in Edina, Minnesota. Thank you for these custom M&Ms. We have some of my lines on there, like, rise up, sunshine. We have my face. I appreciate the gesture, but, you know, I'm really big into fitness. Big on fitness. Whole jar of M&Ms in my mouth. Delicious. I hope your day is as sweet as mine. I'll see you tomorrow. I'm Coy Wire, and we are CNN 10.